All right, Matthew chapter 23. We're at the climax at this point of the conflict, where finally the rules of engagement are about to change. We have had Jesus come in to Jerusalem in a triumphal entry, a magnificent moment where the people were screaming and laying down their coats and laying down their palm branches and saying, "Hosanna to the highest." And once he gets into Jerusalem, the first place he goes to is the temple. And at the temple, he starts turning over tables, which would stop the sacrifices for the amount of time in which he was in there. And he starts to heal the lame and to heal the blind, something that would basically say, as the new David, I am using the temple for a new functionality. The old Pharisees, teachers of the law, the Jewish elite, weren't so happy about this. So they come to Jesus, upset at the actions he's doing, but also upset at the loudmouth little children that are in the temple as well. So they ask him to shut him up. He says no, and the conflict begins. First thing they do is they come to him and they try to trap him with what issue? What's that? What authority? What, by what authority do you do this? And what does Jesus say? Let me answer your question with a question. Actually, he says, I won't answer your question until you answer my question. The question is, John's community, John's baptism, where did it come from? They can't answer. He says, fine, I'm not going to answer. And then he goes and tells three parables that basically rakes them over the coals and says, you guys are the rebellious sons. You're the ones that at the wedding banquet, God's calling people to come in and you refuse to come in. Then three other events occur. What happens? First trap laid for Jesus. In the series of three, it's Pharisees and Herodians, and what are they saying? What are they asking him? Who pay? Yeah, should we pay the taxes to Caesar? And Jesus' response is what? Why would you want the darn coin anyway? It's got his image on it, and that's blasphemous, right? Then the second situation happens. The Sadducees come, and they ask the question about the marriage at the resurrection, something they didn't believe in from top to bottom. And Jesus basically blows their mind by saying, you don't get that kingdom and you don't get this one. But they're really connected because God's the one who provides for everyone in both. And until you get that, you're not going to understand what I'm saying. Third interaction comes, and what's that one occur? The Pharisees decide to get back up to bat. And how do they try to trap Jesus? Which is the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus knocks it out of the park, but he says something quite interesting, that he says the phrase, the second is like the first, which he basically will be pointing back to in chapter 23 a lot, because the second one is the one in which they're not understanding, because they really don't understand the first one. They don't understand how to love the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength. They think it's by keeping all the exact rules, but we're going to find out here in a bit that those rules are just a burden that they themselves weren't willing to keep. And they're neglecting the more important things of the law, like love, mercy, and faithfulness, justice, things like that. Then Jesus comes back. At the end of chapter 22, Jesus says, you know what, let me ask you a question. And he asks them a question based on Psalm 110. Is that right? Yeah. Oh, thanks. For some reason I was thinking 118, but that's today's text. Psalm 110, and he says, David says, speaking this psalm, he says, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. If David calls the Messiah Lord, then how could the Messiah be David's son? Because the son language is usually talking of who is inferior in some sense. In some sense. He says, now how is that possible if David is calling his son Lord? And it says, no one was willing to ask him a question anymore. Verse 46, no one could say a word in reply. And from that day on, no one dared to ask him any more questions. But I said at the end of last class, and I'm going to say it now here at the beginning of this one, that doesn't mean the conversation ends. Just because chapter 22 is done and chapter 23 begins, doesn't mean the conversation ends. In fact, this now, Jesus is going to change the tactics. He says, you know what? Fine, you're not going to ask any questions, enough of you. I'm going to launch my own sort of accusations towards you because I'm tired of this interchange. And Jesus will now begin the fifth major discourse in the Gospel of Matthew. Chapters 23 through 25 is the fifth major discourse. Let's name the first four. Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Mount. Chapters what through what? 5 through 7. Number 2. Sermon on Mission, the mission of the disciples, and which is chapter what? Chapter 10. Number 3. Yes, the Sermon of the Parables, which describes the political value and the nature of the kingdom. And that is chapter what? 13. Fourth one. Sermon on... Yeah, this one's a little bit harder to pin down what it's on, but it's on the community. The value of the community, which is what somebody was saying here just a minute ago, verses 1 through 14, the greatest in the kingdom are. And then the process of the community, or the purity of the community is probably the better word. Because then he starts talking about the discipline, which would be what chapter? Did I already say that? 18. Chapter 18, exactly. First four there. Now we have the fifth discourse. And the fifth discourse is going to be focusing on the battle and the victory of the kingdom. Because chapter 23 is all about the battle. It's coming to a head. It's coming to a climax. As a matter of fact, Jesus is going to issue 7 woes. And we'll talk about the significance of that, although you should already know. And Jesus comes in and he says, it's time for me to take off the kitty gloves and start fighting. Because you guys are acting like big boys. I'm going to treat you like big boys. And he starts to just lay it out why the Pharisees are absolute things like hypocrites and blind guides, which we'll talk about more in a minute. The point is, though, conversation hasn't changed. Location hasn't changed. Where are we? The temple. The audience hasn't changed. Who is in the audience? 3 groups at least. Pharisee, the Jewish elite. Because it is possible that the Sadducees are still hanging around as well. So the Jewish elite, teachers of the law, Pharisees. Although what's interesting here is that in this discourse, chapter 23 in particular, he's going to be more specifically ripping into the Pharisees, and yet he's going to pronounce judgment on the home of the Sadducees, the temple, which we'll get to that at the end. Who else would be in the audience? What? What was that? Yeah, the Jewish elite as a whole. Let's take Pharisees, Sadducees, Herodians, teachers of the law, experts of the law, and say Jewish elite. 2 other groups, though, could be in this particular venue. Disciples and who else?
The crowds.
The disciples and the crowds. So you have 3 different groups. And notice what that sets up. Right there, if this discussion is going to occur against the Jewish elite, in front of his own disciples, and in front of the entire crowds of the temple, we have a perfect situation set up for an honor-shame war. That's what's been happening the last couple of chapters, right? Pharisees and Sadducees are trying to attack Jesus because he's gained a lot of honor. And if they can knock him down, they can regain the honor that he's stolen from them. So Jesus comes out in this honor game war, and he just starts ripping off masks. And it gets a little bit rowdy real quick. Okay, let's dive in. Chapter 23, verse 1. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples. So notice, teacher of the law is still there. He's talking to the crowds and disciples. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Was that wrong? Would the crowds and the disciples have agreed with that statement? First of all, maybe we should ask, what is the statement saying? What is he saying? Teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. What is that saying? Yeah, in some sense, they're the gatekeepers. Right? You have God over here, you have the crowds and the disciples over here, and right in the middle, the gatekeepers are the ones sitting on Moses' seat. The ones, the judges of the law. There is speculation that there was actually a spot in the temple or possibly the synagogue called Moses' seat. We have no solid evidence on that. So keep your mind in the metaphorical realm. These are the gatekeepers. And frankly, the crowds and the disciples would be like, yeah. As a matter of fact, that's what Peter was wrestling with in Matthew chapter 17, verse 24 through 27 with the temple tax, right? They say, does your teacher pay the tax? Because the true gatekeepers don't have to. And Peter's like, yeah, he does. They're the gatekeepers. They sit on Moses' seat. They call the shots of the kingdom. So you must obey them and do everything they tell you. Jesus is, in a sense, affirming that. He's saying, I'm not saying just buck them completely. He'll get to that even more fully later. But what he's saying is everything that comes out of their mouth isn't necessarily wrong. But here's where he starts to shift it. But do not do what they do. For they do not practice what they preach. In our modern day language, what would we call that? a person that does that? A hypocrite. Exactly. And that's actually going to be the moniker that Jesus attaches to them over and over and over throughout this entire period. As a matter of fact, well, we'll get to that. Do I want to get to that now? Yeah, let me back up and say this. What Jesus is doing right here is he's going to be describing what is called the, is the sociological play. They're playing a theater game. And that's where this whole concept of hypocrites really going to come into play. But in the theater game, they have all these different positions. If you are an actor in the theater, then you will have a costume. You will have positions on the stage. You will have lines to say. If people will respond to you in a certain way, you have positions of prominence. There is certain ways in which the rules of theater function. And what Jesus is saying is, they're playing a game. It's a theater game. Where they're saying one thing, but they're actually doing something else. And the word hypocrite that Jesus is going to use over and over and over to describe them is actually the Greek word hypokrites, which sounds very much like the word hypocrite. And where is that word found in ancient literature? In theater. In theater. As a matter of fact, Plutarch describes it like this. He says, when tragic actors put on their costumes, they also change their gait, which is their face, their voice, their bearing, and their language. The person that's doing that is called the hypocrites, because they are appearing to be someone, but they're really not that person. You see how that makes sense in theater? That's the whole point of theater, right? The whole point of movies and acting and things of that nature is to appear as someone completely different than who you really are. And in some contexts, that's admirable. But what the problem is whenever the Pharisees are taking that concept and they're bringing it into the kingdom of God. And they're pretending to be someone, but in reality, that's not who they are at all. They're hypocrites. They're actors on a stage. And Jesus says, let's start pulling off the masks. Let's start ripping the mask back and seeing who people really are. And he says, first things first, they are the gatekeepers. And you know what? Listen to what they're saying, because honestly, they don't even know what they're saying half the time, and yet what they are saying sometimes can be really true. He says, but don't do what they do. Good grief, don't do what they do. They tie up heavy loads and put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. What does that sound like? The language there. What does that sound like?
My burden
is easy. Yeah. Matthew chapter 11. Jesus says, come to me, all of you who are heavy burden, who are tired and restless, and I will give you peace. I will give you rest. For my burden is easy. My load is light. And he comes to them and he says the exact opposite. Oh, they tie up heavy loads and put them on men's shoulders. But they themselves are not willing to move a finger. Not even willing to lift a finger to move any of this. Everything they do is done for men to see. Now, what he's about ready to do here, this section right here, is he's going to start describing the actors. He says they do everything for men to, or they do everything they do so people will see them. Why would they do that? What happens whenever people sees them? What happens? What's that? Yeah, they're gaining honor. But they're gaining illegitimate honor, which is what we'll get to in a minute. So they make sure everybody can see them acting on the stage. And what do they look like? First, let's deal with their costumes. They make their phylacteries wide and their tassels on their garments long. This is part of their costumes. Notice what's on top of his head. Oh, you can't see whenever I point. What's on top of his head is known as a phylactery. And literally, phylacteries, this is a more modern day. And if you notice what's also on his, that's tied to his arm and around his forehand, which maybe has something to do with the mark of the beast. Not that Jewish is mark of the beast. Although, in Revelation, that may be. Anyway, the phylacteries, though, what they would literally do is they would take strips of Exodus chapter 13, 2 through 16, or Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9, or Deuteronomy 11, 13 through 21. And they would literally take the strips and put them in the box so that they were tied to their head and to their forehands. Why do they do that? Anyone know?
It says, bind the words to your head and to your
Yes, exactly. Deuteronomy chapter 6 verse 8 and Deuteronomy chapter 11 verse 8 says, God's saying, I want my word to saturate your very being. Everything that you are, everything that you do, I want it to be based on my words, my commands. He says, whatever you have to do, whether you have to bind it to your head or tie it to your hands, whatever, you do what I tell you to do. And what they began to do is to take those words very literally. Is they say, fine, we will literally bind your words to our head and to our hands. We will tie them in phylacteries. And what Jesus says, oh, and boy, whenever these Pharisees and these teachers of the law walk onto the stage, their phylacteries are huge. Because, my goodness, they have so much Word of God that they have to have on their mind all at once. Their phylacteries are enormous. Everyone can see that. This reminded me, whenever I was in Egypt, 2000 and summer after 9/11. I was weird because I was walking near one of the primary mosques in the entire city, and I noticed these marks on all the people's heads. And so I asked one of the guys, I was like, "What is that?" And he said, "Well," he said, "what it shows is this. It's a rug burn." Because it shows how much they've been bowing and praying. And I was kind of like, well, that's easy to replicate. that's very convenient. You walk around, look how bloody my head is. Why? Because I'm so holy. Do you know how holy I am? I've bowed my head so many times a day, my skin can't even take it. Well, that's convenient. You know, what are modern day examples that we do along those lines?
You do X with these in front of lots of people.
Yeah. Maybe we'll do X with these in front of lots of people, or maybe we'll even do stuff like, no, I'm sorry, I don't want to eat anything, I'm fasting today. Or, my goodness, in my devotional time this morning. Or, man, you know, I prayed for a couple of hours the other day, my knees are killing me. Or, you know, God spoke to me and He said, there's different ways we can flaunt our spirituality in front of people. We just do it a little different. We usually do it more verbally than we do it aesthetically. Because, you know, we're beyond wearing things on our heads. And yet we still play the game. We still play the acting game. And we make sure we strategically place our goodness in front of the right people. You know, bottom line is, if a professor like Mark Moore walks by, you start to act a little different, don't you? Or Mark Scott walks by, you're gonna go out of your way. Hey, Dr. Scott. Oh, sorry, just studying all my word studies. We play the game. It's a little different, but we still play it. And you know what? You also play the game in that there's even competition amongst you. And you get upset whenever other people get a little bit ahead of the game than where you are. And you look forward to whenever people will fail so that it'll possibly give you more honor. It's a part of the game. And even though it's much more visible on them, we still play it. Don't act like we don't play it. Their phylacteries are wide. Their tassels are long. This is their prayer shawl. As a matter of fact, if you look back on the guy before, he's got his prayer shawl going down. See that? If you look more closely, this is what they would be, little knots within them. It's kind of like Catholic rosary beads, where they're sifting through the knots of all the different things they're praying about or the different scriptures they're reciting. And the more knots they have, the longer their tassels are, the more holy they are. But this is very Jewish, because Jesus even has a prayer shawl. How do we know that? The woman with the flow of blood in Matthew chapter 9. For she comes up and she just touches the hem of his garment. Prayer shawl. That's what she's touching. So having one's not the issue. But man, the people that really want to be noticed, they'll make sure their tassels are really long. That way people can know how holy they really are. Because the more knots you have, the more holy you truly must be. They come onto the stage and they have their costumes well intact, because they know how to play their parts as actors. Verse 6, they love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogue. Now what he's describing is their positions on the stage. You see, for an actor, it is very important to know your position on the stage, because the more prominent actors will be the ones that are in the more prominent positions. You know, if you are the key actor, you're not going to be one of the people that's next to one, you know, far back into the set. You're going to be one of the ones that are out front, away from everything else, so everyone can see you more clearly. You're not a background figure. You're prominent. Why? Because you're the most important actor on the stage. So what they do is they position themselves on the stage in the most prominent positions. Those being, like at banquets, where you have the triclinium, the chief seats at a banquet. They would be fighting for them. Fighting for the chief seats. Why? Because even in a setting such as a meal, where you sit gets you honor in the acting game. Because if you're sitting on one of the peripheral edges, then that must mean you're not a very prominent, very honorable actor. So what do? They fight for the chief seats. They do what they can to position themselves as the actors most prominent so that they can gain the most honor. And we do this too. Right? Don't we? How many of you get jealous whenever you hear one student spending a lot of time with a specific professor? Or how many of you, knowing that you spend time with a professor, try to flaunt it in front of other people? We play these games. We do it all the time. Right? Am I the only one that's ever played these games? We play them all the time. We act like the Pharisees are so ludicrous. But we know this game better than they do. We're just a lot more subversive with it. The chief seats in the synagogues, at each synagogue it would shift from synagogue to synagogue. Sometimes it was a specific seat. Sometimes it was a bench. Sometimes it was just a room. Bottom line is, they always would fight for the positions on the stage so that they could be the ones and that all the spotlights are pointing towards. Let's keep moving. They love to be greeted in the marketplaces and to have men call them rabbi. So they go from costumes to positions to the names of the characters. If you are guy number two in the play, you're not that significant of a person, right? But if you have a key name in the play, if you're Edmond Dantes, all of a sudden now it changes, right? If you have a name, then that makes you more significant. So notice where their names are being screamed out at. Where is it at? The marketplace. Very important place for the Battle of Honor. Matter of fact, literally, the people that are most prominent in society would do things monetarily to other people, like they would say, I will pay for all of your food for the next 3 years. And what is that person's job then? The client's job? Is to bring that person as much honor as they can. So the person's job, literally, was to go to their benefactor's house each morning and cry out all the different things that they've done for them. And if the benefactor was going to the market, they would drop everything they were doing and they would go with the benefactor to the market and be talking about all the amazing things that he has done for them. They would go to the markets and say stuff like, "Hey, Rabbi!" Because we know rabbis are in positions of prominence, right? We learn in chapter 17 that the official rabbis don't even have to pay the temple tax. They're exempt. Why? Because they're too important to pay a tax like that. Every character in a play, the most significant ones, will have specific costumes, specific positions, and key names. And this is what Jesus is saying. This is how they're playing the game. And now he's going to start pulling away some masks. Verse 8, but you are not to be called rabbi, for you have only one master, and you are all brothers. And do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father, and he is in heaven. Don't take that and throw that against the Catholics, by the way. You're taking that out of context. We don't have time to talk about it, but I won't be called fatherwood, because Jesus says that's not what he's saying there. Anyway, nor are you to be called teacher. Yeah? See, so I can't be called that either? That's the thing that's always funny to me, is that we're okay with somebody saying, hey, teacher. But Jesus says the same thing, but we're not okay with somebody being called, hey, Father. Nor are you to be called teacher, for you have one teacher, the Christ. The greatest among you will be your servant. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. What is Jesus doing here? He's saying, the entire play, the entire game, I'm rejecting it. It's bogus. Your fighting for honor is ridiculous. Because the only one that bestows honor is not the person sitting next to you, is not the professors in a college, it is Jesus. He's saying, you know what? As a matter of fact, their whole system of establishing honor and value is backwards from the kingdom of God. For the lowliest will be the ones that I exalt. And those that are exalted now will be the ones that will be humbled. He says the whole system is backwards. I don't care what names are attached to people. I don't care what masks they're wearing on the play. I'm rejecting the whole thing. And in rejecting the play, he is also rejecting the Jewish elite and their entire understanding of the kingdom. He's saying, you've absolutely missed it. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You hypocrites. This is the first of seven woes. Why seven? Jewish number of? Completion. He is pronouncing complete judgment. Complete judgment on the Jewish elite, on the Jewish nation, and the way that they identify the kingdom. He's saying, woe. Matter of fact, each of these woes will come in couples. The first three will be sets of two, and then the final one will be kind of the penultimate woe. Every couple, though, pretty much is saying they're emphasizing the same thing. So the first woe and the second woe will be emphasizing the same things, third and fourth, fifth and sixth. The seventh one climaxes because the seventh woe basically describes the way they're going to kill Jesus just like all the other prophets. And that's where he's building up to. So seven woes. There's seven for a reason. Don't miss it. Let's dive into the woes themselves. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those who enter who are trying to. Here's the irony. You are the gatekeepers. We've established that already. You're the gatekeepers. But here's the funny thing. When people actually want to go into the place that you're the gatekeeper of, you won't let them in. You shut the door in your faces. The gatekeeper is supposed to be the one that allows people to actually enter, but you're not allowing anyone to enter. And the irony of it all is, you're not even entering yourself. You're the gatekeeper, and the gatekeeper doesn't even belong to the place in which they're trying to hold the gates open to. Why? Because you're missing the kingdom as a whole. The first woe just calls it flat out what it is. You're the gatekeeper, you're not letting anybody in, and you yourselves aren't going in. That's a problem. Second woe. Verse 15. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You travel over land and sea to win a single convert. And when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as you are. See, I don't know if you've caught it yet, but these are fighting words. He's not messing around. He's saying, I'm pulling off the masks. We're going to call you like you are. You look like you're this incredibly important, prominent actor. Let me show you what you really are. Let's pull the mask off. You're the gatekeeper that is not even a part of the kingdom that you're holding the gate to. As a matter of fact, whenever you do convert someone to something, you don't convert them to the kingdom of heaven. You convert them to the kingdom of hell. Why? Because that's who you belong to. So the first two woes are coupling it, saying, let's look at your ministry and let's look at the result. Your ministry on the surface, your mask is saying, I am the kingdom of heaven. I hold open the door. And people say, I want to walk in. You say, no. I thought you held open the door to the kingdom. Well, I do hold open the door to a kingdom, but it's a different one. Come on, be a part of my convert. Okay, now you're a part of Satan's kingdom. He's saying, let's pull the mask off. Who are they really? Kevin.
I was going to go back. Why is verse 14 missing?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. We don't have time to talk about that. Manuscript issues. There was an eighth woe added in one of the manuscripts. It's not the oldest and most reliable. Therefore, I think the verse 14 is legitimately missing. So, that's the short answer. If you want more information on that, go to the UBS Metzger commentary on the textual critical issues, look up this passage, and they'll have a more extensive conversation about it. Bottom line is, not the earliest, most reliable manuscripts. I don't think the eighth woe is in there. It doesn't really add anything much to the conversation. You can actually read it at the bottom of, well, I'll read it out loud. It says, "Woe to you, teachers of the law, and the Pharisees, you hypocrites! You devour widows' houses, and for a show make lengthy prayers. Therefore, you will be punished more severely." That's basically what he's saying in the rest of them. But that's not in the earliest manuscript, so I don't know why we'd have to insert it. So, good question. Okay, keep moving on. Third woe, verse 16. "Woe to you, blind guides." Notice, this is the only time that one of the seven woes is a different formula. Every other time, it is always, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites." Right here, "Woe to you, blind guides." Blind guides really has two different points here. Number one, that it makes. Number one, that they themselves are not even able to see the truth. That they're not even able to see clearly. That's something that has been coming up all throughout Matthew. It's always interesting whenever he has a discussion about people not being able to see the kingdom for how he's bringing it. He always, right after that, there seems to always be some sort of miracle of somebody, blind people being healed. Because he's showing their spiritual blindness and how they really are the ones that need to have eyes to see. Also here, what it also tells me is not only that they're blind, but it also tells me that people are following them. Because a guide is always guiding someone. So they are blind, but they are guided. And Jesus brings that up earlier in Matthew when he says, it's about as makes as much sense as the blind leads the blind. You're going to fall into all kinds of pits. You're going to have a lot of problems. And that's what he calls them here. "Woe to you, blind guides. You say, if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath." That's interesting. What is significant about that? What does that betray? What they value. What they honor. If anyone says, "I swear by the temple," that's invalid. But if you swear by the gold of the temple, well, now that's an oath. "You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? You also say, if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift on it, he is bound by his oath." What do they value? "You blind men, which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred?" You see what he's doing? He's pulling off the mask. He's saying, your guys' is the first two woes, your guys' political system leads people to hell. How? Because you give them a value system that makes absolutely no sense. The temple is not what is sacred for oaths, it's the gold. The altar is not what is sacred, it's the gift on the altar. You're always valuing that which God doesn't value that much. He's more interested in the fact that the temple is the intersection between heaven and earth than he is about the gold in the temple. He's more interested in the fact that the altar is one of the things that connects him and his people. The sacrifices are there, but it's inconsequential. Remember Jesus in chapter 12 says, "I wish you would go and learn what the passage means when it says, I desire mercy, not sacrifice." They don't get it. They're missing it. Therefore, verse 20, "He who swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it." Notice that this conversation is not as much about oaths as it is about what they value. Because we've already had the discussion on oaths, right? Where have we had that discussion? Sermon on the Mount. Exactly. "And he who swears by the temple swears by it and by the one who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven," he adds one, "swears by God's throne and by the one who sits on it." He's saying, value what God values. You're missing it. You're playing the game and you're misunderstanding the kingdom as a whole. Verse 23, fourth woe. "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness." So he says, when it comes to the whole things that you value, the tithing, he says, boy, you get down to the mint, dill, and cumin. These are some of the most fine, smallest garden herbs you could get. They're very fine, very small. He says, down to the minute, when it comes to the tenth, you guys are champs at that. But when it comes to the more important matters of the law, that is a phrase that should ring very loudly in your ears. For what is he defined as the more important matters of the law? Justice, mercy, and faithfulness. Justice, mercy, and faithfulness. How you treat the least of these. See, that's showing up here at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, or at the Sermon, well, on the Mount of Olives, on this fifth discourse, and that's how it's going to conclude. Because it is going to conclude with the sheep and the goats. One on one side, one on the other. One side values what? Justice, mercy, and faithfulness. The other side doesn't. And that's the distinguishing mark. Why? Because justice, mercy, and faithfulness are the most important things in the law. They're the more important. That's what Jesus has been hammering the whole time. That's why he says, listen to what they say, just don't do what they do. They're right whenever they're reading from the Old Testament and the prophets. The problem is they have highlighter theology. We've talked about that. They really want to highlight the stuff about the tithing. But, you know, helping out the poor and the oppressed, whatever. Even though things like Isaiah 58 are just screaming at them. Then listen to what Jesus says. This is very important. He says, you should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. He's not saying get rid of the tithe. He's saying you should do the tithe. But you shouldn't neglect what is at the end just so that you can accomplish what's at the beginning. Do both, he says. Keep the tithe. But my word, if you are neglecting justice, mercy, and faithfulness, much bigger deal. He says, I wish you would have kept this and done this. I wish you'd have done both. Although I will... Never mind. If you're going to choose one, choose wisely. You should have practiced that without neglecting the former. You blind guides, you strain a gnat but swallow a camel. I love that. It's kind of like saying, my word, you have a beam sticking out of your eye, but you're looking at the speck. Good grief. You get these really small things, and you make sure it stays out, and you're clean and pure. But then you grab a camel, which is unclean, by the way. And you eat that stinking thing. You're missing the elephant in the room, he says. Everyone sees it, but no one wants to talk about it. That if we follow your political system, what does it result in? People being oppressed. The Gentiles being destroyed. And that's not what God asked you to be. You'll strain out that gnat, but my word, when a camel comes along, let's swallow that baby. And we act like we're still fighting for the same kingdom. Jesus is saying, I'm rejecting the entire play. You hypocrites. All right, let's keep going. Fifth woe. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say it like that. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. He's intensifying his accusation. You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they're full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, then the outside also will be clean. He's saying, good grief. You're so worried about stuff like making sure that you follow the traditions of hand cleansing. But don't you know that what comes out of your mouth, not what you put into it, is what makes you unclean? He's saying you're missing the point. What is eating you alive is not your lack of attention to the dietary laws. What's killing you is the fact that you're neglecting what is inside. It is eating you from the inside out. On the outside, your mask makes you look beautiful, wonderful, honorable. But on the inside, you're a mess. You're a mess. Same thing that he's going to say here in the sixth woe. Woe to you, teachers of the law. You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of dead men's bones and everything unclean. I don't know how you could say something more offensive. This is not my homeboy Jesus. This is my Jesus that's not taking anything from anyone. He looks at him and he says, man, on the outside, you look beautiful. But tombs look beautiful on the outside. I'm more worried about what's on the inside of you. Yeah, you're dead. You're spiritually a mess. You're like dead man's bones, which is unclean, right? You see what he's doing? He's saying the way in which you guys are preserving yourselves on the outside and keeping yourself clean is actually what this stuff, this unclean stuff, is actually the way you look like on the inside. I mean, you're swallowing camels, you're full of dead men's bones. No one would want to touch you if they knew it was behind the mask. Problem is, you wear the mask really well. Man, you look good. But tombs look good. It doesn't mean that there's something that you want to go in and live inside. In the same way, on the outside, you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside, you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You build tombs for the prophets and decorate the graves of the righteous. What should they be building? See what he's saying there? Whenever it comes to honoring someone that truly is a servant of God, something that you should build, you know, incredible ark, you know, stuff honoring them, what do? You build their tombs. Why? Because you're the ones killing them. And you say, if we had lived in the days of our forefathers, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. Kind of like says, man, if God would just speak to me nowadays the way he spoke to them, I would be a much more devoted follower of Jesus. Really? Your actions betray the truth. So you testify against yourselves that you are the descendants of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the sins of your forefathers. What he's saying is this. You say that if you would have been alive when your forefathers were, that you would have honored the prophets, and yet whenever prophets are coming to you today, what are you doing to them? The same thing your forefathers did. He's saying, like father, like son. You're a bunch of murderers. That's all you do. When God sends you people to call you back to repentance, what do? You kill them. So that you don't have to listen to God. So you can hide from him, so you can ignore him, so that you can call the shots in the kingdom, so you can be king. You snakes, you brood of vipers, come in full circle, Matthew chapter 3. John calls them brood of vipers the very first time. How will you escape being condemned to hell? That's not a question you want somebody to ask you with the expectation of you can't. I mean, seriously, that doesn't make you feel good. Hutch, how will you escape being condemned to hell? Honestly. You see the... Holy cow. The answer is, you can't. And he says, the only way that you can is if you listen to the prophets that are coming to you and the ones that you're killing. He says, therefore, I'm sending you prophets and wise men and teachers. In other words, the only way you can escape hell is if you listen to the prophets and teachers and people I'm sending to you. Some of them, but this is how they will respond, you will kill and crucify. Peter's going, huh? Yeah, Peter, that's you. Others you will flog in your synagogues and pursue from town to town. Kind of sounds like Acts, eh? How were the Jews responding to the prophets Jesus was sending to them, the teachers? Killing them, crucifying, flogging them, chasing them. And so upon you will come all the righteous blood that has been shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. He's saying, from Genesis all the way to today, all that blood on your heads. Why? Because you're just like your fathers. I tell you the truth, all this will come upon this generation. In fact, whenever Pontius Pilate tries to set Jesus free, and they refuse. They keep saying, crucify him. Finally, Pilate walks out and he washes his hands in a basin and he says, I am innocent of this man's blood. And they say, fine, may his blood fall on our heads and on the heads of our children. They are enacting, they are committing to what Jesus is describing. He says, I tell you the truth, all this will come upon this generation. You're darn right it is, because they've asked for it. They will ask for it. Verse 37, you can hear Jesus' heart truly come out in verse 37. Not that his heart hasn't been, but this is not something Jesus gets giddy about saying to people. See, do I have time to say this? 2 minutes, we'll do it. There is a pendulum when it comes to Jesus that we swing too far on both sides. One of them is being this pansy Jesus that just will only hug people and not eventually thump them in the head. And we have this other one where people think he's just the sadistic Jesus. He just loves getting mad at people and calling them sons of hell. And it's more in the middle. It's more in the middle. That he will come to somebody and say, "You're messed up." But then he'll look at him and he'll say, "And that breaks my heart. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who killed the prophets and stoned those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as hen gathers her chicks under her wings. But you were not willing." He says, "You have no idea how much it breaks my heart to indict you like this. You have no idea how I've longed to protect you and to guide you and to... But you don't want it." Then he looks at him and he says this, "Look, your house is left to you desolate." What is their house? Temple. This is the first prediction of the destruction of the temple that will dominate the conversation in Matthew chapter 24. "Look, your house is left to you desolate." In other words, this conversation doesn't end once we move on to chapter 24. "Look, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" He is quoting there Psalm chapter 118, verse 26. Why is that significant? What? It is a battle psalm. It's the Hallel Psalms, one of the key ones that they were singing at the time of Passover, right? Psalms 113 through 118. This should sound familiar because I first was talking about this in chapter 22 or 21 when he was coming in the triumphal entry. Because what were the people singing? Psalm 118. Then in chapter 12 or 22, whenever he talks about the capstone that you rejected, comes from Psalm 118. And now, ending this interaction with the Pharisees, he looks at him and he says, Psalm 118. Listen to what they say. Just don't do what they do. Why? Because they're actors playing on a stage. And I'm pulling back the masks and saying, this is my kingdom. And you can choose to be a part of it or you don't have to. But bottom line is this, judgments are coming. Look, your house is left to you desolate. And that's what we'll pick up in chapter 24, Tom Orr Rowe. Love you guys. See you then.